Good afternoon from the Hart Senate Office Building in sunny Washington, D.C. I'm Lucy Vernasco, the Digital Director for the Joint Economic Committee, Democrats. Thanks for tuning in. This morning, the Joint Economic Committee held a hearing titled, A Record 6 Million U.S. Job Vacancies, Reasons and Remedies. If you didn't tune into the hearing, there are a few key takeaways. More than ever, obtaining a good-paying job requires more skills and education. Second, we need options for success. Everyone should have access to an affordable college education, but that can't be the only path to a job. We need vocational education, middle skills pathways, apprenticeship programs, and opportunities for lifelong learning. Lastly, investing in skills and education is one part of the equation. Congress must also be pursuing policies that create good jobs and support the workers in those jobs. Our ranking member, Senator Martin Heinrich, summed it up well today.
For workers to remain competitive in the future economy, learning and skills development must continue over the course of a lifetime. Companies must get back in the business of investing in their workers, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the prosperous thing to do for the business and for workers alike.
Today, our chief economist, Adam Hirsch, sat down with our Democratic hearing witness, Dr. Betsy Stevenson, professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Professor Stevenson was formerly a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and chief economist at the Department of Labor. Adam asked her about the current labor market and the so-called skills gap mentioned in the hearing earlier today.
Professor Stevenson just testified at the Joint Economic Committee hearing, A Record 6 Million U.S. Job Vacancies, Reasons and Remedies, which listeners can watch and find written testimonies for on our website, jec.senate.gov. Professor Stevenson, a lot of talk at today's hearing focused on the so-called skills gap and whether this was driving problems in U.S. labor markets, including slow or no wage growth and a difficulty finding good jobs for a lot of workers. So I guess to start out, what is the skills gap? Do we have skills gap in sufficient quantities to be explaining these problems?
A skills gap is when there aren't enough workers with the skills that employers want. But anytime you talk about a skills gap, you need to talk about it in terms of a wage. So, for example, we don't want to ask the question, are there enough skilled machinists? We want to ask the question, are there enough skilled machinists willing to work for $25 an hour or for $35 an hour? And the answers to these questions are different. So putting it in terms of the wage is really important. What we expect to see is that in a competitive labor market, if there's a skills shortage, if there's a skills gap, then the workers who do have those skills, because that doesn't mean no one has it, it means there are too few people with it, those who do have the skills should see their wages getting bid up as employers who need these skills compete to get access to the limited number of workers that have the skills.
Or presumably the employers then would, if they couldn't find the skills and the supply wasn't there, they would step up and foot the bill for training the workers to develop the skills they need.
Exactly. It's another way that employers can put their money where their mouth is they can offer to train workers to develop those skills.
Well, this is an interesting point because the United States, of course, has one of the most open and flexible labor markets in the world. So if the labor market isn't functioning well like this, why is it that employers aren't offering better wages or better training opportunities?
That's a great question, and it's one of the big puzzles in the labor market right now is why is wage growth so lackluster? And you know, one of the things economists point to is there's been a slowdown in productivity growth. But even if we put that aside for right now, what we've seen is a divergence between productivity growth and wage growth. So we aren't seeing workers, even when they become more productive, getting the kinds of wage gains that you would expect to see in a competitive, flexible labor market. And there's many potential explanations. Some of it's coming from changes in our labor market institutions, like a decline in unionization and reduced worker bargaining power. And then on the flip side, we see increased employer bargaining power because we've seen an increase in establishment size. Firms are growing and becoming bigger and have more influence over their workers. And then they engage in anti-competitive policies like asking their workers to sign non-compete contracts, which mean that a worker who might be in demand by another employer can't actually go to that other employer. And by limiting that competition, you're going to keep wage growth down. And then finally, we've also seen just reduced worker mobility, which is another aspect which reduces workers' bargaining power. It's harder for workers to pick up and move these days. And as a result, they're changing jobs less frequently and they're seeing less of the kind of wage gains that we expect to see when workers are able to frequently change jobs.
Ranking Member Heinrich discussed in his opening statement today the importance of community colleges and the role they play creating opportunities for students at all levels. He specifically mentioned the Central New Mexico Community College example, where they're using a federal grant program and working with state and local partners to create a pipeline for IT workers, providing the training, work experience, and then helping place students in jobs with local employers. I wonder if you could just talk more about the role that community colleges play in America's education and workforce development.
Yeah, so one of the most important skills that all workers need in the 21st century is the ability to learn on the job and adapt to new technologies and new ways of doing things. And that's why successful programs teach not only concrete skills, but help participants develop lifelong learning abilities. And when we look at some of the strongest community college programs, they have pathways that lead specifically to jobs and often have pathways that lead to further training. So transitions to four-year degree options, the ability to build stackable credentials, and proven employment outcomes are the types of things that are necessary to show successful community college programs. And the programs that are getting access to government grants are doing a good job of both thinking about building the pipeline forward, connecting students to further education, and looking backwards and connecting it to students when they're younger, because we have to develop that idea of lifelong learning, which means that our programs are more integrated from sort of cradle to death.
And particularly with lifelong learning opportunities, but really with all education, we know that people face substantial difficulties paying for that education and training. One thing we heard today from another witness, David Harrison, who's the president of the Columbus State Community College in Ohio, was that so many of his students need to juggle their responsibilities for work and family with their time that they're investing in going to schooling, and that for those students, it's really critical to be able to have access to benefits like childcare, paid leave, health insurance. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the reasons we see for this coming from the economics research. Why is this so important? And then, you know, more broadly beyond student workers, what are the benefits of these kind of family-friendly policies for the broader economic, for the broader economy, and for helping people realize opportunities?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people have a stereotype of the typical student in their head as being an 18-year-old who's being helped out a bit by their parents. But in reality, the typical college student has a lot of their own responsibilities, and a very large share of them have children of their own. And so when we think about building training programs, when we think about building community college programs, we need to ask what kind of childcare is available. And do we are people actually going to be able to balance that with their family needs? More generally, this is why we need robust childcare policies and paid family leave policies for the entire economy. We don't want to hold people back because they can't get the childcare they need in order to develop the skills that will allow them to get a higher paying job and provide more for their children and lead to greater success both in their career and their children's careers because of a simply ramified or remedied problem like access to childcare. We've also seen that when people know and feel confident that they're able to take time off when they have a birth of a child or when they have a sick family member or their own illness, that they have greater attachment to the labor force. And the same thing's true with completing their education. you know, one of the challenges the United States faces right now is making sure that people not only get into college, get into a community college, get into a four-year program, but actually complete the programs they start. Because the way that you earn higher wages and you're able to justify your investment in these programs, as well as the government investment, is to complete them. And so we need to be building the infrastructure that allows people to complete these programs.
So I guess what's true of student workers is also true of workers more generally in the labor force, that having access to childcare, paid leave, these kind of benefits are really important to having people fully realize opportunities to work.
Absolutely. You know, there's way too many workers who are lose a job or are unable to take a job because of the fact that it doesn't work with their family. In fact, you know, a survey showed that half of parents said they had turned down a job because it would have conflicted with their family responsibilities. When people have access to things like childcare, that's going to be one of those barriers we're going to remove, that they're going to be able to take the job where they're going to be most productive and know and have confidence that their child is going to be nurtured in a high quality, affordable childcare center. And with things like paid family leave, we see that parents are able to maintain better attachment to the labor force, are able to follow better career paths, longer career paths, when they're able to take time off when they need it for the birth of a child or for to care for a sick child or a sick family member. This builds labor force attachment, and that by building labor force attachment builds their career paths, builds wages.
I thought one of the interesting points raised by Congressman Don Beyer of Virginia in today's hearing was that in his experience as a business owner, he found that offering paid leave to his employers actually reduced costs for his business.
You know, business owners are people too. And even though economists like to think that they have all the answers all at once, it turns out that they don't. Sometimes they have to do learning by doing, just like the rest of us. And what we've seen recently is lots of businesses have been learning that it's actually cost saving to introduce things like paid family leave policies, flexible work arrangements, that these things lead to lower turnover, lower recruitment costs, more worker loyalty, and greater worker productivity. And as a result, they end up saving money. You know, one of my favorite stories is a business that realized that they could save money by increasing the amount of paid family leave they were offering because the increased cost of the adding a few more months was less than the reduced turnover they got by moving from, you know, a few weeks of paid family leave to a more robust paid family leave policy.
You know, we talked about how important community colleges are for students training for the workforce now and for people throughout their career to be able to retrain and have lifelong learning. But I thought an interesting point made by David Harrison, who again was the president of the Columbus State Community College in Ohio, he made the point that the skills of workers entering and in the workforce today and going into the future begin to develop, you know, as early as when they're in utero, neonatal, and it continues throughout the early life, primary and middle school. Yet we know that opportunities for access to quality education are highly unequal across the U.S. A lot of it depends on where parents can afford to live. How does this kind of inequality of opportunity impact the individual's ability to develop? And then how does that, when you add up all those people, how does that affect the overall economic situation?
You know, so research has increasingly shown that early childhood education is extremely important to develop lifelong skills, to develop the kinds of skills that are going to allow kids to succeed as adults. And, you know, we take programs where early childhood programs where they studied the effects on, say, third grade test scores and found that they didn't have a big effect on third grade test scores. But then we go back later on and see, well, yeah, we don't actually care what the test scores are in third grade. What we care is what the lifelong outcomes are. Typically, test scores are correlated with those lifetime outcomes. But when we look at these early childhood programs, they're most robust evidence is that they lead kids to become more productive adults who are better attached to the labor force, who are less likely to do social harm, like engage in crime. And so these early investments really matter. So we know that. And now at the same time, we have seen a huge increase in inequality among kids, bigger than what most people realize, because there's two things that are happening. Adults, we've seen increasing inequality among adults, but then we see that the richest, the most educated adults are postponing having children until they're older and their family incomes are quite high, and less educated individuals are still having their kids when they're quite young. And that's led to an even greater increase in inequality among kids. So we see these super neighborhoods where where housing is very expensive, the schools are very good, and the way that you can get into that neighborhood is by being in your mid-30s as a professional with a six-figure income. And then you've got these kids who are growing up in neighborhoods with people in their early 20s where they have less education and less income and way less access to early childhood programs. And this is creating a huge gulf that is going to continue to affect the macroeconomy for decades to come unless we close this gap that is continuing to grow among the kids of highly educated people and the kids of less educated people. We need to be giving all kids a much more even start so that we have a chance for them to all grow into productive adults.
So I think so far we've cleared up a lot of the misunderstandings about what's going on with the skills gap and what are the real problems that workers are facing in getting skills to have access to good jobs. Now I want to talk about, you know, what we should be doing, especially here in Congress. You know, this year we've seen from the president's skinny budget proposal to the Republicans' plan to end Medicaid as we know it and kick 20-something million people off of health insurance. The Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's agenda, which looks a lot like cutting funding and starting to privatize public education, and so many other things. It seems like we're moving policy in the wrong direction, but where should we be moving policy to address all these challenges?
Well, we had, as a society, gotten to a place where people could take a breath about health insurance and know that it was going to be there for them, regardless of what kind of hardships came their way, whether they lost their job, whether they were diagnosed with a chronic serious illness, no matter what happened, they would have access to health insurance. And if we take that away from them, that's a big amount of uncertainty that we're putting back on people's plates, and that's an important removal of access to healthcare. I mean, we've seen that people have had more access to healthcare. There's fewer uninsured people. And that removes a cognitive burden from people. They don't have to worry about health insurance. Instead, they can focus on being productive in their jobs. Instead of saying, how am I going to get access to health insurance? It's, how am I going to get a job where I can get paid as, you know, the highest wage possible, where I can be as productive as possible? So I think it would be a mistake for us to take a step backward to a time when people thought about health insurance first and the quality, other aspects of the job second. You know, when it comes to education, we all benefit from investing in the skills of children, of adults, of all workers. Because when people are more skilled, they're more productive. And when they're more productive, we produce more as an economy. And that economic growth benefits us all. And so we don't want to move to a world, and then that's one of the reasons in which, that is one of the reasons that we have public investment in education, because we want to be able to take advantage of all the talent that's out there, not just the people who are lucky enough to be born into families that can afford it. And when we look at the education sector in particular, we know that's a sector that is, you know, really easy for people to take advantage, for unscrupulous businesses to take advantage of people. And we've seen that in recent years with for-profit colleges that have left people with student loans that they couldn't pay because they left them without developing skills that would lead to the wages that would enable them to pay those loans back. You know, you hear a lot of discussion about the problems in student loans, and yet the data shows very clearly that the problems in student loans are primarily concentrated among people who went to for-profit schools or who went to other two-year schools that didn't deliver employable skills to them. And therefore, the amount of debt they have is not that much. But when they aren't earning very much, it's insurmountable for them. And so we need to crack down on on, you know, unscrupulous business practices, taking advantage of students, and make sure that we, you know, continue to move that in the right direction, as we have been with things like the gainful employment rule.
So you discussed some of the things that workers need to be able to get a good job and access to the middle class life that most people are looking for. And what do we need to do as a country to make sure that our economy is producing good jobs in the future that are going to be there for these people?
Well, we need to restore the balance of power between workers and businesses. And you know, one of the things that we've seen is that workers are losing bargaining power as unionization rates have declined, as businesses have grown in size. We see that workers are less able to negotiate for themselves. And then when they do, they seem to have less support from the less support from government officials in workers today, when they stand up and they say, you know, what this employer is doing is illegal, we need to make sure that we're backing them. And there's too many stories of workers who report employers for not paying fair wages, for wage theft, and you know, we need to make sure that those employers are held accountable and that workers know that they do have a voice, that they should be standing up, that they have a right to discuss wages with each other, they do have a right to do that, and that their employer can't fire them for discussing their working conditions, whether they're in a union or not in a union. So we need to make sure that workers have access to the kinds of infrastructure that supports them, like paid family leave, which we've already talked about, and flexible work arrangements and a good education. But then we need to be doing things to boost productivity. Now, economists point to the fact that we have low productivity growth. And there are three drivers of productivity growth: innovation, business investment, and investment in our workers, investment in human capital. And what we've seen is that we're not doing enough investment in workers. We can do more. We know we can invest more in early childhood education. We can invest more in community college. We can do more to make four-year colleges affordable. We know that we can do more to improve innovation. We've seen government decrease the amount that's being spent on research and development. And we really, because research is something that has big spillovers and benefits lots and lots of businesses, we need that public sector investment in it. It's the classic example of a public good. Everyone's going to benefit, so we need that investment in research. And that's been one of the big drivers that's helped prompt private sector innovation, has been government investment in research, and we need to see more of that. We need to make sure we're tapping in to entrepreneurial talent across the full pool of available folks here in the country and outside the country, by making sure that women, minorities, have access to capital and are able to develop an idea and turn that idea into an innovative product. And we need to see businesses restore their investment in a way that they just haven't been doing for quite some time. And you know, in order for businesses to be encouraged to invest, we need to make sure that we have a very competitive market where businesses know that if they're not investing, if they're not innovating, they're under threat from a competitor who could drive them out of business. And we need there to be less uncertainty about some of these policy questions that have been on the table. For instance, we established health insurance and we removed the uncertainty from that, but we've put that uncertainty back on the table. So we need to give businesses a better sense of sort of where things are going when it comes to government stability. And let me just end by saying, you know, one of the big challenges we have is trust has declined. Trust in government and trust in each other. And what really makes a market-based economy work is trusting each other. And if we don't restore trust, we're never really going to get the kinds of economic growth back that we have had in the past.
This is something that, transaction costs, which economists like to talk about a lot, but without trust, it becomes a lot more costly to have these kinds of engagements. You need lawyers, or maybe you don't even end up having the dealings at all when you can't trust the other party.
Right. I mean, you see this increase in transaction costs, and then people don't want to work with certain groups of people because they don't trust them at all. And then that's going to mean that you're picking within a smaller pool instead of who's going to be most efficient, who's going to be the best provider. You want to work within your small community because you're afraid of dealing doing business with somebody outside it. Or you put in a lot of you put a lot of protections in place, like lawyers. We see, we see this in countries where they have to develop lots of security, where there's lots of third-party verifiers, where, you just don't, you can't have an everyday transaction because you can't trust the person on the other side to hold up to their end of the bargain.
So to tease out a thread from our conversation, it's economically bad when we exclude people from participating in these things.
It's absolutely economically bad when we exclude people from participating.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Stevenson, for joining us today.
It was great talking with you.
Thanks for tuning in. To find more information on the Joint Economic Committee, visit jec.senate.gov. Or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at JECDems. Thanks.